Hello, everybody, it's Jughead, and here we are again. Weekly, it seems to be happening that way. I don't really have much to say today, I really just want to get into the interview. I would like to say that Ali and I conducted this interview a couple months ago, but he was willing enough to be part of my archive collection, storing up for the holiday months, and here it is released, and his new EP has been released also fairly recently, so it works out pretty nicely. I just want to say, if you can, take the opportunity to go to the website, www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com, press the button that says Patreon, and that'll take you to a place, another place, where you can join the patrons at the $2, $5, or $10 tiers. At the $5 and $10 tiers, you get unedited videos of all of the interviews before the at-home audio audience receives them. That's something special. Plus, you get some Q&A time with me, and also you get some shit in the mail. Swag, I also like to call it. If you can't do that, I completely understand, and you hear this every single week. If you are listening, you need to do something for me, please. That would be great. You can, if you can't do the cash thing, that's all right. Just write a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, or at least share one of your favorite episodes, any of the ones you want. In this episode, we talk a little bit about Jesse Michaels, which I tend to like to do a lot. I would also recommend the Crimpshine episode. That's it. Let's get into it. Right now, you're listening to Out of Time by Zebrahead, released on their 2021 EP called 3 in Roman numerals. Hello, and welcome to Jughead's Basement, episode 103, subcategory Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests. Today, we interview Ali Tabatabai from Zebrahead. Today we talk about such things as moving from Tehran to California, choosing music over a medical profession, path to a major label, the influences of rap and hip-hop, and his battle with Hodgkin's lymphoma. Plus, of course, much, much more. So, let's begin. Hear that woman say recording in progress?
Oh yeah, she was yelling at me.
So hello, nice to meet you, Ali.
Nice to meet you. Do you prefer me to call you John or Jughead or?
I go by both. It's whatever you're comfortable with.
Okay, cool.
People, Juggy, Jughead, John.
Okay,
it's all right good. On. It's all good. Cool, okay, cool. How long have you been sporting this bleached top of your head?
Not very long. We've been doing a little bit of filming. We have done a couple of videos and stuff. So I was really bored sitting at home for the last year and a half. So I was all excited to do up my hair. So
so I don't know if you're familiar with me or this at all, but I try to do a lot of studying, and then I put the notes around me. And then I try to do it more spontaneous and let it go. Like if you have questions, throw them at me. I'll ask you. I mean, I'll keep it controlled. I'll try to go through a timeline. But it's mostly about you and
by talking about you via you, we'll talk about the band, but I try to focus more on the person itself. So I think to me, that's a little bit more engaging, at least for a conversation.
Okay, cool.
I wanted to dig into the first of all, just the, I love talking about school in general. So let's go back and to like when you were just a child.
Yeah.
And you were actually born in Tehran, right?
Yeah, Tehran in Iran.
Tehran, is that what I said? Yes. I don't know much about the history. I tried to look a little bit, you know, back. I know I lived it being traveling with a punk band at the time. And I know, not that time, but because I was young too.
Yeah. I was going to say, man, you've been doing it for a long time.
Well, I thought, you know, now, I mean, my record, my brain hurts, just had its 30th anniversary. So that's, wow. And so I started maybe 5 years before that. Yeah. Yeah. So it's crazy. So what's, give us a little, did your leaving have anything to do with what was going on in Iran at the time? Or was,
yeah. Yeah. So we left there when I was six. So I don't remember a lot about it. You know, like my earliest memories are like hanging out in my grandma's backyard, you know, and riding a tricycle around and stuff. And
yeah.
So my dad tells me a story, like when the revolution started happening, you know, they didn't know how serious it was. And they were just hoping, it wouldn't be a thing where it would last a long time. And they honestly didn't think anybody was going to have to flee. They tell me a story of like, my sister is younger than me. She's like 2.5 years younger than me. And my mom and my sister Layla went down to the corner market to like, I don't know, pick up some things. I think Layla wanted a toy or something. So, and this is a normal thing. And my mom said, when they were down there, somebody just started shooting into the streets. And so they had to, you know, flee. And after that, they came home and, you know, my dad was like, I'm going to send you guys, my mom, Layla, and myself to live with my grandparents. My grandparents lived in La Mirada, California, because I had some uncles and they were going to Fullerton College at the time. So we had some family in California. So he sent us to stay with them. And then he stayed to try to like sell like property and like try to get the finances together and stuff. And so pretty much we left. He came like a month later and pretty much with nothing. They didn't get an opportunity to do much. The government pretty much stopped people from selling and taking money out and stuff. Wow. So we were living at my grandparents for a while. And then, you know, I was again, six years old. And, you know, eventually they bought a house in La Habra, which is pretty close to La Mirada. Mm. And I grew up in La Habra and went to high school in Sonora High School, which is right there. And that's where I met the guys in the band. But, you know, for me, I don't really remember a lot of it being in Iran and stuff. Like, I just remember growing up here for the most part.
Were you already, let me know about, were you already a multilingual house? Did you speak English back in Iran or
like none of us did.
Do you remember learning the making that transition as a kid?
Yeah. I mean, what's funny is where I moved to in La Habra, like it was just me and my sister, that, you know, I think there was like one other kid, but he wasn't even in my class. So they put us in ESL, which is English as a second language, but everybody else in the ESL class spoke Spanish.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Yes.
So, I mean, we were like, they were teaching us the way they would work with the kids who spoke Spanish. And so I don't know how that worked. Honestly, I don't really remember much of it, but I do remember I was a pretty quiet kid. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I, you know, couldn't communicate.
Yeah.
Properly. So, yeah. So that was, you know, kind of my experience coming here and trying to, you know, learn English. And
do you have many memories of the separation from your dad at that time, from him not being there?
You know, not a lot, only because it was so exciting for me to come and see my grandparents and, you know, my uncles and stuff were all here. We had come to America before. My parents had like brought me over to like go to Disneyland and stuff when I was like, even younger. Yeah. So, yeah, like, yeah. And we'd stayed with my uncles and my grandmother and stuff. So it was like, it was exciting for me because I just had fondness for, you know, America and like seeing my grandparents and stuff. So obviously it was a much different experience for my mom, who was telling me that when she came over, it was her and my other, I had a cousin who was like maybe 5 or 6 years older than me. And then me and my sister, which was 6 and 4. Wow. And so they didn't speak any English and they had all these bags and they didn't know, you know, my mom was taking care of all three kids. And she said that, fortunately, the people that were working at the airport that day saw that she was struggling with all these bags and the kids and everything. And they went out of their way to come help her and made sure she got all her bags and got on the right flight. And, you know, obviously, when she tells the story, it was very stressful for her. But for me, I just, my experience was, oh, my God, I'm gonna go see my grandparents and maybe go to Disneyland.
To me, that's like a sign of a mother's job well done, because her job is to try to keep you as calm and safe as possible, even though it may be chaos for her at the time.
Yeah, totally. My mom is, you know, a very strong person and, you know, always made sure that me and my sister weren't stressed on too many things. So,
yeah. Do you come from a, does your wing of the family, are they very family oriented? Are you very close? Like,
yeah, uncles, I have a and huge, cousins and, yeah. huge family. Man. Yeah. Like, when we all get together, it's like 80 or 90 people. Like so, and like my younger cousins now are having kids and one of my cousins got married last week. So they're, the family just keeps growing and growing.
Yeah. Are you challenged to remember everyone's names? I'm no good at that myself.
Yeah. I mean, I try to do my best, but you know, there is a lot of us.
Yeah. I don't even know. Are you married or have kids or are you?
No, single? I don't have any kids. I'm single. So I'm one of the few in the family.
Wow. Yeah. Actually my family is mostly all single, but I'm in my 50s and have never been married either, but
yeah. Yeah. It's hard. I mean, traveling and stuff.
Yeah, I know. I it sounds pretentious, but I've often been in relationships where I had to say that weird thing of like, well, art comes first for me. And it sounds like such a weird thing to say, but maybe it meant I wasn't really ready for a serious relationship. And I use
I've been in relationships and stuff. I've just never been married.
Yeah. Yeah. I assumed you'd been in some kind of relationship. one of the questions I've been asking lately, you actually just brought it up in a different manner, but I'm still curious because you definitely said you were quiet in class, but you had these other circumstances that kind of caused that for you to go to school like that. One of the reasons I started this podcast amongst many was that I felt all through the years of Screeching Weasel, I was like the business guy and I booked all the tours and I made sure everyone was okay. I was like the mother of the band.
Yeah.
But I suffered from that. I didn't actually talk to all the people that we met as much. I only made like a few friends, whereas like Ben was in contact with, you know, Billy Joe and everyone from every band.
Right.
So a lot of this was to engage myself with people a little bit more. And then I started thinking about and talking to a lot of the guests about schooling and education and where did they speak up in school, and not regret, but do you often wonder whether if you had, this is what I think about, whether I had been more vocal in class and questioning things, what would I know more now of? So I'm just curious as to your thinking of yourself as like an education person growing up. Like you said, you instinctively already were a little quiet because you were trying to figure out a language, but did you have more of a nature that was a questioning nature, do you think?
Yeah. You know, so I had a really unique experience because when we moved into our house in La Habra, there were a lot of kids on the block and, everybody was pretty much white. I think there was no other like ethnicity that I remember, but I remember my sister and I were like playing in the front yard when we just had gone there, and all the kids from the neighborhood came and kind of surrounded us. Right. So, they were trying to talk to us and we couldn't communicate, but, there was this one guy who was older and he was like a bigger guy. I think he played football or something in school, and he made sure to let everybody know in school and in the neighborhood that if anybody messed with us, they were gonna have to deal with him. So, and he was kind of a cool kid, whatever. Yeah. And so we met a lot of his friends and they just made us feel like a part of the group, you know, like we didn't really feel like we were different. And so once we started, my sister and I started learning English, we did become more vocal. We had friends, you know, they made us feel really comfortable and We never saw ourselves as different for the most part, even though we're the only Iranians in school, I think, growing up. So once I started learning English and speaking English, I became a little bit more outgoing and I tried to participate more. I started doing student body stuff. I was president and stuff. So I started.
Were you president?
Yeah, dude. I did.
Did you get voted in?
I got voted freshman, junior, and then student body president. In my senior year. Yeah. So I was really annoying, dude.
What got you elected, you think? Did you make some promises?
I have no idea. It's so long ago, but I'm sure I did. Recess is going to get extended. Everybody gets Twinkies or whatever. You know? It was a cool experience.
I like going through this too, because in a lot of the things I was looking up online about you, I like talking about schooling anyway, but it does talk about the eventual choice you made between pre-med and going to for medical school and doing the band. And that's something I think a lot too about how seriously are you going to take your creativity and being an artist? What are the ramifications of making those type of decisions? So can we talk a little bit about, we're skipping a few years. We went through high school and now we're making that choice to whether to go to college or not.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I went to UC Irvine, which has a great pre-med program there. So I was a biology major there. I took that very seriously. I never partied or anything in college at all. I was trying to, focus on my grades and stuff. I graduated and I took a year off to take the MCAT, which you need to get qualified to get into school. And during that year, I moved back home with my parents. And at that time, some of my friends from high school were around, mainly Ben, who plays bass in Zebrahead. And I started hanging out with him and he was in the music scene. He liked go see NOFX and Jawbreaker and all these bands. And since I was home, I'd go with him, because all my friends in college were gone, they were gone. So yeah. I started hanging out with my high school friends again. Yeah. And so I started going to shows and studying for the MCAT and whatever. I took the MCAT and while I was doing all this, Ben was in a punk band and he used to share a rehearsal studio with our drummer, Ed. And at that time, Greg, who was in a band with Ed and they were called 409. So Ben was, there's just a lot of number names. Ben was in a band called Fly. They were in a band called 409. And then there was another band practicing there with Justin, who was the first singer in the band. And so I would go sit on the couch while they rehearsed so that we can go to see NOFX after or, whoever, or go to a bar. And so I'd be sitting there. And growing up, I was really heavily into hip hop music. And Ben knew that. So, and I think at the time I was listening to a bunch of Cypress Hill. So he would go up and play the Cypress Hill bass line on his bass. And he'd be like, dude, grab the mic and do Cypress Hill. And so I go there and this is Cypress Hill or not, whatever. And Ed would start playing the drums. And then, so we did that for a little while. And I remember Ben's band, those other two bands, The Party, right? And it was a place called Coos Cafe in San Francisco.
Hey, this is Jughead in the future. There was a little bit of trouble with the internet with Ali's answering this question, but I think you could understand where it jumps to here. Basically, the bands played at the party and then they asked him to join them on stage.
So I went up there and I did the song and the response was so much higher for that project than for the rest of the bands that the dudes were like, maybe we should, start a band or whatever. And I was like, okay, yeah, that'd be fun. I have, a few more months before I have to go.
Yeah, yeah.
So we started playing shows and writing music and stuff. And so I applied to medical school and I got into two programs. I got into Finch University. At that time, it was us and five guys in the band and then five girlfriends that would be at the shows. It was nobody was there, what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But this guy who ran the club had come in one night to get the money from the bar and he saw us play and was like, maybe they can get a record deal. I don't know why he thought that. But so then he reached out to Todd, who came to our rehearsal studio, and he's like, would you guys be down if I tried to get some, A&R people? And we're like, yeah, whatever, dude. Sure. That's going to happen. And so we went, it was a Christmas show, I remember. And we went to play and it was everybody's girlfriends. And then there was 12 record companies there. And it was that was it.
They were the audience.
They were the audience. And it was insane. We'd thought it was a joke, whatever. Yeah, yeah. And then we get Arista, Clive Davis, was like, hey, I want to fly out to New York. And I want to see you guys play here at Arista. And so I was like, whoa, this is kind of getting serious. So yeah. We went and we came back and they made us a record off a deal offer. And then once that got out, other companies got more serious and we ended up getting an offer from Columbia Records. And that was the same week I got my acceptances to those two schools.
Wow.
And so I remember talking to my mom and dad and I was like, so I have this opportunity where it looks like I'm going to be able to travel and tour for at least a year. And my whole thing was I'm young right now. How cool would it be to be able to kind of see the world at this age and not have to wait until I'm retired or something. Cause yeah. If I start going to medical school and everything, that's, you know, it's going to take up all my time. I'm not going to be able to. And they were like, well, can you defer, you know, can you defer for a year or something? And at that time you could, I don't know what the deal is now. And they were super supportive. They're like, why don't you defer, go do this, see what happens. Cause they understood also Columbia is a good record label and yeah. You know, they know what they're doing. So I did. So I deferred and we signed with Columbia and then we just started touring and making albums and loved it. You know, I never went back.
Yeah. It's hard to go back into that frame of mind then, but was there much hemming and hawing back and forth for you or do you just know that you needed this year to do the band?
Yeah. You know, it was stressful only because, you know, that's such a big decision all my life. I'd been focusing on one thing and then yeah. A new opportunity came along and I really was interested in it and loved the idea of it, but I wasn't well versed in it. Like I didn't study music, you know, I felt like I had a lot to learn and stuff. Whereas with medicine and stuff, I'd been, you know, studying for it for so long. So that was stressful for me. But it was, you know, in my head, I'm like the way I learn things mainly is by doing them. So you know, it might take me a little bit of time, but I'll learn how to do this. And even if it's for a year or two, then I can come back. In my head, I initially thought I was going to go back. And then we just were lucky enough to be able to continue and our fan base grew and our fans are honestly the only reason I'm able to still do this. So I just, and then, so all my friends became doctors. So right now, anytime I get sick, I'm like, you know, hey bro, like I have a, you know, I have a headache, or they're dentists or they're veterinarians, you know? So I'm all hooked up with any like doctoral needs. So, but yeah, so I, you know, I'm happy that I continued music.
Yeah. You made me think of a question, which might be hard to answer, even hard to ask, but you know, often very, I don't know, education-driven families are like, you got to be a doctor. It's financial reasons. And then you have people that are doing it because purely because they want to save lives and they want to change the world. And then there's gray areas in between the two.
Sure.
Did you have that? What was your sort of outtake on that? What did being a doctor in the medical field mean to you? And were you able to focus any of that into your music?
You know, obviously making money and stuff is important. You have to be able to survive. But mainly for me, the aspect of being a doctor was always how, you know, you can help people. You know, you can help them get through an illness, a physical illness. But with music, you are also in a place where you can help people because in my own experience, music has gotten me through a lot of hard times. And it allows people to, you know, express themselves or express themselves through your songs. And so I never felt a disconnect with that. Like I always felt like music also helped people. And that was the main thing for me. So I was never like, I blew it or, you know, like I wanted to help people and I wasn't able to. I feel like music in its own way does do that as well. So I think that's the common thread between the two careers, I guess.
Yeah. I had to go through that too. Cause I never really knew what I wanted to be growing up and I never had our family was too much chaos, 5 kids, 1 mother, no, you know, a father wasn't around. So it was more about how are we going to live and eat tomorrow? Not like what college am I going to go to?
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally.
But I remember really being nurtured by my mom and myself to being a teacher. And then I made the decision also to do music too in theater and stuff like that too. So I asked the question because that's kind of a process I was constantly going through. Like, even though I do art, I still wanted to make some amount of change or some positive effect on the world around me, or at least the people I can touch that can touch other people and so on. So yeah. I had wondered whether you had those feelings too. And as a lyricist, I assume you did have that sort of take.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a, you know, it's great to have somebody relate to a lyric or a song that you wrote. And I often don't like necessarily talking about what a song is about, because I feel like everybody makes it personal to them. Like when they hear a song, oh, this is what it is to me. And in whatever way that I'm able to allow somebody to do that with our music, you know, I think it's such a special thing. And because I've done that with numerous bands that I like, and I'm like, oh, that song is so important to me, you know, and it's a cool thing to be able to have that experience with other people.
Yeah. Well, this seems like it'll lead us into talking about being a lyricist through the years. So you are one of the predominant writers, if not the other people write lyrics to. I know music, the whole band seems it.
Yeah.
You got a lot of really strong, great musicians in the band. So I figured that's probably one of the reasons too. In the early days, they were like, wow. Because I can just hear it with all the records, like the bass playing and the guitar playing is really nice.
Yeah, those guys are, you know, phenomenal, phenomenally talented players. And we do write the songs together. I tend to write my own lyrics for my parts. And then the other singer oftentimes write their lyrics. But, you know, we do work together. Like if somebody goes, hey, you know, I have an idea here. We're really easy like that. We're like, oh, you know, let's work on it. If it's, you know, if it's better, I'm all in.
Yeah, I would think you would have to, because I know the way Weasel moved along is that it became early on obvious that Ben was only comfortable singing his own songs, like Ben Weasel. And I was okay with that because I had my theater world and other writing world. But it must be interesting having two singers and both. I mean, everyone wants to feel sort of an ownership over their own music. So you're putting words into their mouth, they're putting words in your mouth, and they're putting their own words in their mouth. Yeah. Is that over the many 13 records, has that dynamics of that changed, especially since you've had a couple different singers?
It depends on the person. I know I remember Justin, the first singer, was he would call me all the time and be like, hey, dude, I have this melody. What do you think? Like lyrically, like, and we'd go and like have a beer or something and we'd like go over lyrics and stuff. With Maddie, he tended to like to write his own lyrics more than not, but he did also, we did work together every once in a while. With Adrian, the new singer,
he's very new, right? Like this year.
Yeah. Super talented guy. And he is a front man of his own band, assuming we survive. And so he's been used to being the main guy and like writing everything. But he's been such a pleasure to write with. Like, we're, you know, everything is new because everything's with Adrian's recently happened, but there'll be so many times because we're both night owls where like, I'll be sitting on my couch at 3 a.m. and then I'll get a text from Adrian and he'll be like, hey dude, I have this lyric. What do you think? And then, you know, I'll be like, oh, that's awesome. Wait, let me, you know, and I'll send back. So I'm learning how to work with Adrian, but he's super open to being creative, working together on not only music, but lyrics. And even like, he'll be like, hey, dude, what about this flow for like this part of the song? And that's new to me. Like people, you know, in the past haven't been like, I have a rap idea for you. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
it's been really cool getting to work with him and figure out how we're going to be writing for the, you know, the newer songs.
Has there been like a growth in how you have the singing work off each other? Like, is there often like a response to what the other person is saying? I'm saying this from, because sadly, I don't know all the, like the lyrical content of music, but I'm very interested in how two singers work that out. And if there is some play with the, what is this voice saying compared to that voice?
Yeah. So usually the way that we work is somebody will have an idea, like whether it's, I write a verse, I send it out where it already has like the lyrics and the idea behind what I'm trying to say. Then I'll send it to Adrian and then he will listen to it and say, okay, this is what this song is about. Mm-hmm. How can I add my part to this to follow the same idea? Mm-hmm. Or vice versa, where Adrian will be like, hey, I have this part. This is what the song is about. And then, so then my job is to create my part that resonates his idea. Mm-hmm. And then we, you know, work it out to try to hopefully make it feel seamless going in between, you know, the two vocalists.
Was it, do you think it was it natural for you once from the beginning to, I know often, I coming from as a musician first, it's hard for me not to have something in my hands. Did you have a sort of a learning curve on how to be I guess one of the front men. You don't have like one person. It seems like it sort of takes people take turns stepping forward, and then it's equal. But what is your learning curve on what do you do with your hands, Ali?
I don't know. I never thought about that. I don't know why that is. The mic is, you know, like for me, the mic and the mic stand.
Yeah, you do have your tool. It's like a cigarette is
right?
A tool.
It's so like your anchor, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess the mic and the mic stand did that for me, where I didn't feel like, is this weird? You know, like,
yeah.
So, I guess that the mic and mic stand were my guitar, bass, or, you know.
Yeah, I find it's fun watching different, even the rock bands, when I watch like Steven Tyler from Aerosmith or even Jeff Pezzati from Naked Dragon, how people use that stand or don't use that stand. You know, are they whipping it around? Or Steven Tyler has like scarves hanging down. Jeff Pezzati, I don't know if you know Naked Dragon, but he's like connected to it. Almost like the Ian from Joy Division, where, you know, he's really connected to it. Then he backs up and just kind of freaks out.
Totally. That's cool. Yeah. I love watching other bands, just other like front men or whatever, because it's inspiring to see what they do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think like, I remember Korn at the time when we were starting out was blowing up. And I remember watching him and the way he used to use the mic stand. That always stood out to me because he would thrash around with the mic stand in his hand. And I always thought that was pretty cool. So, I mean, I get inspired, you know, when fortunately we've been touring for so long, like anytime we get a chance to watch other bands play, you know, you get a little, you know, oh, that's cool. Like, you know,
yeah,
I did something similar to that, you know, or that, you know, it looks cool for him. I'd look like an idiot doing it. You know what I mean? Like you just learn a lot from watching other people too. So
was there ever a moment where you figured out or thought like, oh, wow, it's up to me? I mean, you got the whole band behind you, but it's up to me to get that audience involved. I say this because I've watched a couple of videos of you and you're really good at that, making eye contact with the audience and trying to bring them into what you're doing when the other singer is singing. Or is that something you felt you came natural to, or do you have to go, I have to engage with that audience?
You know, initially when we started, I was very, it was hard for me to like do the whole eye contact thing. And but then doing it so much, like, you know, when I said initially, I never studied music. I never studied playing. So there was a learning curve, right? So I think that for me was my schooling, was the first like 3 or 4 years of touring of like, okay, you got to make, and again, like there's certain people like Billy Joe from Green Day, like watching them play and watching how he is with the crowd. We did a tour with them many years ago and I learned a lot from watching him every night and the way he would interact with the crowd. He's a master at it. And like watching other, like I said, frontmen and how they do it, and like, you kind of pick things up and go, hey, we could use that in our set, you know, how to engage with the crowds and stuff. So I'm still learning, you know, like, well, you know, we'll play shows and stuff and I'll be like, oh, that's an amazing thing. We should try to bring that into our set somehow.
Yeah. I know. I saw that you had covered with Real Big Fish. You covered Unity, and Jesse Michaels is a pretty good friend of mine. And when you talk about frontman, that's like one of the guys that comes. I don't know if you ever got to see him play.
And yeah, I like didn't. Unfortunately.
Yeah, and the sad thing is that he doesn't. I mean, he's like me. He's got so many his hands in so many different pots that, that he's not always playing. But he's one of those guys that's riveting to watch. Like he's jumping all around. He really brings the audience in. His lyrics are engaging in that way too. That sort of try to create a community.
Yeah, I have to check that out.
Yeah. No, I actually thought you did a really good job on that Real Big Fish cover.
Oh, thank you.
Singing that. Yeah,
thank you. I've known those guys forever. And yeah. You know, we tour with them since we were kids. So it's you know, their family.
Yeah. This has actually come up in a couple of podcasts and I'm disappointed in myself on not knowing as much about rap as I should, but I did get a glimpse of what I really liked when I saw this, like back in the 80s or early 90s, Ghost Dog. It's one of my favorite movies by Jim Jarmusch. I don't know, you know, if you even know that movie.
I don't know that movie.
Oh, I'm surprised. All the music is done by, what's his name?
Is it Wu-Tang?
Yeah, it's Wu-Tang and Raza or RZA or RZA.
Yeah. I don't remember the. You know what? I've never seen that, but I do remember when that came out and everybody talking about the RZA doing it. And I it's like a samurai movie or?
Yeah, well, it's yeah, he's kind of a samurai in the city and he lives by the samurai code.
Code, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I also bring it up because that's a good transition because you have done pretty well in Japan and I live in Japan half the, like a lot of the time for the last 6 years. So we're getting there, but I wanted to get there via a little talk about rap and the hip hop.
For me, like I when I was a kid, I used to play basketball a lot in elementary school and stuff. And all my friends listen to hip hop. That was like their thing. So we would be sitting there before we play, like we were in this like league called NJB, which is like National Junior Basketball, right? It's kind of like Pee Wee baseball or whatever. But like everybody on the team would listen to hip hop music. So we'd be practicing and, you know, somebody put on NWA and Ice Cube or whatever. And it was like, at that time, a lot of my other friends listened to punk music, rock music. But what I found was, and I found this later on, hip hop and punk are very similar in that there's so much aggression and energy that comes with the music. So before the games, we would put on like Ice Cube or Eazy-E or whatever to get us pumped to play. And that was just became my introduction to music and the emotion and the energy that I got from that before we went to play a game, I really connected to. And then I really got into hip hop. I got into like, I came from the suburbs. So like, I loved NWA. I loved Eazy-E, Ice Cube, but I wasn't, you know, in Compton. I wasn't where am I getting shot and stuff. So there was a disconnect there. And then I started listening to other like acts like A Tribe Called Quest, and their hip hop style is completely different. It's not about like, you know, shooting other people or fighting. It was just like their experience in New York, you know, like Fife and Tribe Called Quest. Like, I love that where they're like rapping about everyday stuff and not necessarily I'm going to, you know, shoot this person or have a like dope ass car or whatever, you know what I mean? So I started relating to that and delving more and more into hip hop. Beastie Boys, huge, huge fan of the Beastie Boys. And that's all pretty much I listened to until high school. And my friends, Ben, like the bass player, and like all of his friends were like really into Metallica, early Metallica. And like, so they started like getting me into that. And I love the aggression too. I'm like, that's really aggressive as well in a completely different way. And that started broadening my musical tastes. And so I started listening to more rock and like punk and stuff. But mainly like my love to is even now still, I mainly listen to hip hop. That's what I grew up on.
I'm in territory I don't know much about at all, but and you're not actually just a white guy. You actually are Iranian, so you have a little color. But did you have to deal with like accusations of appropriation? And I don't even really, music to me is it's the world owns it. So I don't really have any strong feelings on that. I'm just wondering whether bands that do crossover stuff like that deal with that at all. Like,
I mean, I don't know if I honestly haven't dealt with that. I don't know if they're giving me a pass because I'm brown. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Some kind of, you know, she's not white, so it's okay. I don't know. Nobody's really given me a hard time about it.
Yeah, you know? I don't even know if it's an issue. That's what I'm saying. I'm out of my depth in that. I just didn't know if that's even like something that you deal with. I know there's a lot of other bands.
Not to my face, John. You know, what? Not to my face.
It's to my face. Not your face. That's what I was thinking.
There you go.
No, I had to ask because I was curious. Does Zebrahead ever had a chance to play with like straight out rap bands or hip hop bands?
One of my favorite little tours we did was with Cypress Hill.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was so cool, man. And like after the first show, I was like talking to their tour manager or whatever. I'm like, dude, the reason I'm in this band was because I used to go do Cypress Hill songs while Ben played the bass, you know?
Yeah.
And so the next day, the dude comes up to me. He's like, hey, Be Real wants to talk to you. You have time right now? And I'm like, hell yeah, I want to go talk to Be Real. And so he goes, yeah, he's on the bus, you know? And so I'm like, I knock on the door and like Be Real's like, hey, what's up, man? Want to come in? And I'm like, yeah, dude, I want to come in. And he's sitting there like rolling the fattest joint. Like, And he's just like giving me advice about like how to have a long, because this is when we're starting out. Like a long career and like mentality wise, like he's like the people in your band or whatever, you're going to fight with them. And I don't know if you have already started or whatever, but this is something that's eventually going to happen. And you have to like realize that these are your brothers or whatever and manage the fight in a way where it's not going to be something that's going to turn into a bigger thing. and understand that it's normal. And then also, like, you know, make sure you try to own as much of your music as you can. Like, he's just giving me all this knowledge.
He called you in to teach you?
Dude, it was the last thing, man.
To school,
smoking his joint and, like, and like, he's like, you want to smoke a little bit? I'm like, you don't want to smoke with you? Be real. So, like, and, like, talking. And, yeah, we played a few shows with them. And he was a very kind person. And it was a great experience for me. And then a lot of the times the only other times we play with hip hop acts are in festivals, you know, when there's all these other bands and other genres. We do play with hip hop artists, not as much as I'd like to.
What are some, just for my audience that may not be familiar with it and myself, what are like some modern now? Has hip hop changed into a different name now, or is it still around as hip hop and what are bands that are doing it now?
I mean, rap, but you know, there's so many. I think it's like the biggest selling genre right now in the world.
Yeah. Wow.
But yeah, there's so many good artists out. You know, I love ASAP Ferg. He's out of New York. He's from a group called ASAP Mob. There's a collective of artists that not only create music, but they do like clothing. They do like art installations. They do, it's like a bunch of people that are just very creative. Mm-hmm. And there's ASAP Ferg and ASAP Rocky that I'm huge fans of. Juicy J, I've been listening to him a lot lately. I love his like beats and stuff, you know, and I still listen to old school stuff. Like, you know, like I said, I love the Beastie Boys, classics, you know, Tribe. I still love Tribe, even though Fife passed away.
There's an interview I just read a little while ago. You had said a comment, not, I wouldn't say offhanded, but it wasn't what the topic was about, but it made me curious. You were talking about one of your producers and how he knew how to, you know, work your vocals, the rap style vocals. And it made me think about, and let's talk technical a little, as much as you want to or know, what is the difference between like recording like a melodic vocalist singer and recording someone who's rapping?
Well, for me, it's because I don't sing, you know, like lyrics make my parts for me. I feel like, because if the lyrics aren't strong, then there's no melody, then why are you caring? Why are you invested?
Yeah.
Whereas I feel with singers, like in general, melody is just as important as lyrics. You know, it's a whole different experience. And the producer I think you're referring to is Paul Minor, who last few albums, and actually I saw him a couple of days ago because we're tracking now. But he's went out of his way to be like, hey, dude, like try this pattern of rhyming. Other producers that I've worked with in the past have generally been, as long as they felt like the lyrics were strong enough, they were like, that's great. Let's put it down. Paul has been trying to be more involved in not only making sure the lyrics are great, but hey, why don't we change this pattern here to this for this line, and then go back to this for this line. And that's like the first time really that I can remember that a producer had taken that into consideration while working with me.
You're talking, you'd already been a band for at least a decade or longer, right? Since he started.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the other producers are great.
We're not questioning that, but the fact that someone started talking to you more deeply about that is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, the other guys were really focused on, okay, the lyrics are strong enough. And they would tell me to rewrite all the time. It's not like they were like, okay, yeah, just write whatever you want. They're like, hey, that sucks. You need to go and fix that. You know what I mean?
As technical as, is there like a, this is once again, waters I'm not as familiar with, but is there like a mic difference that you would use? Like you would choose to use some different type of mic or mixing it?
I mean, not really. Like sometimes when I'm doing demos and stuff I'm at home, I like record on a harmonica mic because it has like a weird distortion feel
it. Yeah.
And like all my like plugins and stuff are like different distortion plugins or like, different reverb plugins and stuff. I do like to change the way that I sound. Oftentimes though, I'll go in the studio and be like, dude, use this. And then everybody be like, you know what? It's cool, but you can't understand a word you're saying.
Yeah. That's very important. Yeah. Like you had said, it's important to understand what you're saying.
Oftentimes I push it to like an extreme. And then once the recording gets pulled back to like a middle of where I want it in, where, you know, they're like, let's have it super clean.
Yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
Just kind of put it where you can understand what I'm saying, but it still has a little bit of grit and like distortion in there.
This is a question I just thought about this because I deal a lot with Mass Giorgini. I don't know if I'm a producer and also was in Weasel and a bunch of different bands. And his drummer have been working together for like 40 years. And they're like exactly what a drummer and rhythm and bass player are supposed to do. You know, they work together as a unit, like the backing of the band. Yeah. Do you find yourself over time listening to them more for your, I don't know, for your guidance, for your, where you're going? And how does like the guitar or bass affect, probably emotionally affects it too? I guess I'm just, I don't know. Is that a question?
Yeah. Totally. No, it's a great question, actually. So for me, when I'm writing, what I follow is either a guitar line, a bass line, or a drum pattern, right? And it depends on what like sticks to me. Like when I listen to it, I'm like, that is what I want to write to. Because there's, you know, all three are going on at the same time. And whatever inspires me, I'll use that as the inspiration for my rhyme pattern. And also, when we're writing, especially since the pandemic and stuff, like I've been working a lot from home. So I've been like making my own drum loops and parts, looping parts that I find cool. And then I'll write to that. And then I'll send it out and go, hey, the BPM is like one.
Okay, this is where, yeah.
Right. So this is my rhyme pattern. What do you think about a guitar part for this? And then, you know, Dan will be like, oh, what about this? Or Ben will be like, what about this bass line? You know, or Adrian as well. So, it just varies song by song on, did I write it to a loop and then send it out? Did I get a cool drum part that I was inspired by, or was it a bass part or a guitar part? So it's different always for me.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me. It seems like it would be so different to write from a rhythm rap part, which you're saying is there's still some melody you're dealing with. I mean, you have to go different pitches and that,
yeah,
but you're having a guitarist write to a rhythm sound. That's really fascinating to me. I'm sure a lot of those type bands that are have hip hop within their music are doing that. But to me, that's completely like I come from like even like a Bob Dylan singer songwriter, the melody is the first thing that ever comes out, you know? Like,
Yeah. It's a completely different way to write, I guess, you know?
And
like for me, this
that's
is all
you've been doing. That's what you're doing since the beginning.
It's not weird to me, but I guess it is super weird.
Did you have, I like to ask the question, where do you think your propensity towards creative decisions in life have come from? Do you have like a family relationship with art or creativity?
You know, my dad is an architect. I was an architect. He's retired now. And my mom was always into like drawing and stuff, but not really. Like, we don't have any musicians in the family or anything like that. I was just a huge music fan, I think. Even as a kid, my parents told me I was just like always listening to music and stuff. So I don't know what it is that like inspired me to go in that direction.
I think about that with myself a lot because my best friend growing up, John Braun, was the most amazing musician. And my brother he was also a con man, but part of that brain was that he could play any instrument and just pretend like he knows how to play it.
Amazing.
And then I'm the one that actually made a career out of it. Like the one who's like, I don't know, I'll pick up this instrument. Maybe this will work for me. You know, just that creativity is random that way. You just don't know.
You had an innate ability to understand music.
Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control.
And welcome to the middle of the interview, where now we get to present to you our one and only advertiser. And this is Siren Records in McHenry, Illinois. I really love this place. My friend, the Linquists that run the record store, are a pretty great married couple. They're very passionate about their record store. It's a great place to visit. It's very homey, and they have a great selection of contemporary and classic music and rock and metal and a bunch of different passion projects. They're really into the Lillingtons and Teenage Bottle Rockets, so a lot of interesting posters and records from that gang. They also deal with cassettes, and they will buy old records and cassettes from you. And if you go into the back room, you see that they have an amazing selection of old and new stereos, record players, amplifiers, speakers. It's a pretty fascinating place, and they do a lot of repairs on things like that too. Got a staff that works there in this little cubby hole with all these amazing tools. Anyway, you can visit their website at SirenRecordsMcHenry.com. You have to put the McHenry in there, M-C-H-E-N-R-Y. So once again, that's SirenRecordsMcHenry.com.
Back to Ollie and Jughead.
Johnny's got a problem that he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem that he's out of control.
This is out of context, but it's in my mind now, so I'll ask about it. You dealt with Hodgkin's disease.
I had Hodgkin's lymphoma.
And that happened right while you and going in to create a Playmate Out of the Year record. Was that your second or third record or early on?
It was second, yeah.
Right. Do you mind talking about what you went through with that?
No. So we were on tour. We were doing Warped Tour. It was like the year Eminem was on, Blink, like all these bands were on. I remember Black Eyed Peas. They would set up basketball courts, right? Like, so when backstage or whatever, people would play basketball, and I was playing one day, and I was like Black Eyed Peas and Eminem, like we were all playing. Yeah. And I went up for a rebound and somebody accidentally went under my leg. And so I flipped back and landed on my back. Right.
Oh, man.
And, I bruised like my ribs and stuff. So they had to take me to the hospital. It was pretty brutal. I was like on crutches, and they gave me these like really strong painkillers. Right. Yeah. So that I could play every day. So I'd take the painkiller, go on crutches, and I finished out the tour. And then at the end of the tour, like 1 week left, I'm like, I'm feeling okay. I don't want to take these pills anymore. So I stopped taking them. And then I started, when I'd wake up in my bunk, I would notice everything was sweaty. And I'm like, dude, I've been taking these pills for like 2.5 weeks and I'm having withdrawal. Like, that's insane, right? So
yeah.
Happened every night. I went home and we were supposed to leave for another tour, had like 3 days off, had the weekend off. And we're heading out for another tour. And my dad saw me. I hadn't seen him in a while. He's like, you don't look so good. He's like, you should go see a doctor. And I'm like, oh, Dad, it's fine. I stopped taking these painkillers, whatever. And I'm like, I have a show tonight. I think it was at the Roxy or something. I have to go. You know, I don't have time to go to a doctor. And I'm leaving in 2 days. And then he was like, okay. So I started getting ready to go sound check. And he called. He's like, hey, I made you an appointment. The guy can see you right now if you go over there. Somebody canceled. And so I remember I walked into this doctor's office, and it was this French doctor, and walked in. He looked at me and he goes, I think you have Hodgkin's lymphoma. And because I, you know, was pre-med stuff, I knew lymphoma was cancer. And I was like, this idiot, like he looked at me and he knows I have cancer. Like, come on, bro. And so he's like, I want to do a chest x-ray. And I'm like, okay, but I got to do it real quick. So I got to go sound check, whatever. And he's like, okay. Took an x-ray and I bailed. And I went to sound check. I'm on my way up to sound check. I get a call from him and he goes, you have a large tumor in your chest and you need to cancel your tour.
Oh, man.
So I was like, you know, I was 27 at the time.
Yeah.
So I let the guys know we canceled the tour. And then I went back in, and like in a week later, I started chemo, and I did that until that was done. And then I did radiation for a period of time. So we, you know, postponed everything. And the guys actually started working on Playmate while I was going through treatment and stuff. And so I wasn't there quite that much for that album because all the other things I was dealing with. But so I went through the treatment and the radiation, everything, and knock on wood, you know, I've been cancer free since.
Yeah. I read something, I do refer to the wiki because sometimes it's great. Sometimes it's horrible, but it's a good starting point. But I talk about that. It said that some of the songs from that record are special to you because of that the time you went through. And I imagine it's, my God, going through that and then coming and being with the band was probably even more of a relief to be able to get your mind off of that probably while working with them, but yet it probably seeped into what you were writing and doing. Is there any direct correlations as to like lyrical stuff or how that music feels to you and what you went through?
To be honest with you, that album is my least favorite album. And I don't know. I mean, maybe mentally it reminds me of that time.
Yeah.
Full time, you know? But yeah, I mean, I don't listen to the album very much, so I'd have to go back and be like, listen to the songs, you know, maybe this lyric was about this or whatever. Yeah. But I do have like out of all of our albums, I'm just like, I don't really like that one that much.
I guess we all have our albums we don't like, but do you think that is related to that,
maybe,
like period?
Yeah, maybe.
Or maybe it's just not a good record. That happens. Yeah. Hey, when you have 13 or 14 records, you can say that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm glad you made through that. And do you still have to have do you still have checkups occasionally just to make sure you're
Oh, right? Yeah, yeah. Like you go annually now for me. So
Yeah.
They do it usually a chest x-ray and then a blood, you know, test or whatever. But it's good. I feel like in a lot of ways, because I do go every year, like if there's anything going on like other than cancer, they'll also catch that.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, yeah. So it's good to kind of keep up with that regardless. So.
Yeah. Well, doctors are good.
Doctors are good. Yeah. All my friends listening, you know.
What is your relationship to like, okay, I was talking to Dan Vapid, who was in Weezer with me, and we're talking about the differences between wanting fame or wanting success. Is that different from even popularity or creative fulfillment? What is, you've had a career, you've had highs and lows, and you've been around a long time. And you've had really successful records and real successful videos and some not so successful. But what are your feelings on success and artistic integrity?
Everybody measures success differently. And it changes, I think, also as you get older. You know, yeah. When you're younger, you're like, you know, oh, I want to be, you know, super famous and be like a rock star or whatever and do this and do that. And then as you get a little bit older, it's like, you know, how can I kind of do something that makes a little bit of difference in somebody else's lives? Like your focus changes. And as I get older, I notice like just being able to have the opportunity to create and be a creative person becomes more and more important to me. When we started, I remember it was, I want to tour. I want to travel. I want to play shows everywhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then it kind of changes as you know, you grow up and you grow older. So, I guess it just depends on what part of my life you're referring to. But for me now, especially coming out of the tail end of a pandemic and stuff, it's really important for me to be able to continue and to be able to be creative and to be able to make music and be creative in other ways as well. And to also be in some way a positive influence or have a positive effect on people around me or people that do listen to my music. I mean, that's, I guess, what it is for me now.
I think that was leading to me because you had started within the pandemic this Fear No Empire, which is predominantly people from Zebrahead and another drummer, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, where it's Mike Cambria, who is in a band called Death by Stereo. That is also our guitar player's band.
Yes.
Like very incestuous, man. Like a Game of Thrones episode in this. But yeah, so I met Mike through Dan. We toured in Australia with him. And I love the way he plays. Like he's such a rad drummer. And during the pandemic, Zebrahead, everybody's taking a break. And I was consumed a lot by Trumpism and all that was happening. And combine that with being locked in your house and, so there was a lot of anger, I guess, that was building up. I'm sure not only for me, but for a lot of people at the time. And I'd always wanted to do another project. I've always been a little bit more political than I've been in Zebrahead, like in my own mentality. And right. So
it's not like someone else is telling you not to be as political. It just seemed that you were going with what the band dynamics are bringing to the table. And you wanted something Zebrahead slightly different.
Super political, do you know what I mean? So it never really made sense for me to do that in Zebrahead. And once we had an opportunity, we took a break. I remember reaching out to Ben, our bass player, and I'm like, hey, dude, because when Ben and I actually started Zebrahead, we were writing together and it was a little bit more aggressive. Like the things that we were writing were heavier and a little bit more political and stuff. But then Zebrahead happened and that changed. So I called Ben up and I was like, dude, do you want to, you know, do another project where we're kind of back in the old school when we started and a little bit more heavier music, more political based songs and stuff. And he goes, dude, I would love to reach out to Dan and then Mike. And they were all into it. So we wrote an EP during the pandemic and, you know, we released that. And so now we're actually starting to work on our second EP. So we're continuing with that as well, but it's great, man. It's a different way to flex your creativity and different style of music, you know? So
yeah,
it's inspiring.
Yeah. I bring it up also because I like talking about band dynamics, and you've had a couple people come and go, but a lot of them have stayed for long periods of time. And you've also gone through periods where it seems like people that have been there from the beginning or started the band have left too, and you've decided to continue on. So yeah. Where's the question in that? Like, how do you deal with those dynamic changes? Was there ever points where the band just said, are we really, it's like that. I forgot the name of that philosophy, but that boat, but if, you know, over the centuries, they keep on taking pieces off of it and rebuilding it somewhere else. Now, which boat is actually that boat?
In the metaphysics of identity, the ship of Theseus is a thought experiment that raises the question of whether an object that has had all its components replaced remains fundamentally the same object. The concept is one of the oldest in Western philosophy, having been discovered by Heraclitus and Plato by 500 to 400 BC. Back to Ali and Jughead.
Have you had discussions within the band? It's like, are we different now? Are we the same? Do we grasp that difference by the balls and make it what it is? I guess it's a more of a vague question for you to take it wherever you want as to how dynamics change in a band that has been around as long as you guys have.
I feel like anytime we have a change in the members, it's usually me and Ben and like Dan now, especially we like call and go, hey, dude, like, where are we at? Are we, you know, do we want to continue this? Is, you know, are we at a place right now where we feel like we want to, you know, find a new singer or new guitar player or whatever? This last time week, when Maddie left and it was during the pandemic and stuff, we took a minute to really think about it.
That's like 2006 he came in, right? So that's like 14, 15 years or something, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
2006, yeah, 15.
Am I right? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead. No, I wanted to place that for the audience so they know the depth of what you're talking about.
It's a long time Maddie was in the band. What happened was, my whole thing was, dude, like, it can't be exactly, we don't want somebody that sounds exactly like Maddie or Justin. And also, we need somebody that is going to be dedicated and also somebody that's really talented, you know? And I don't know how to go about finding somebody like that. And Ben goes, dude, I met this guy maybe 6 years ago and I was so blown away by him, and his band was like getting a lot of hype and stuff. And I don't know what he's doing now, but I feel like he could probably pull it off. His voice is really phenomenal and he's a guitar player. He's a great guitar player. So I was like, okay, what's his name? Whatever. Googled him, Adrian Estrella. And then Dan, our guitar player, goes, I know Adrian. I used to go to a bar and we used to drink together all the time. He's awesome. Cool dude. Great guitar player. Amazing voice, whatever. And so I started kind of looking at his other bands and going, well, his own music is amazing. It's different than Zebrahead's. It's not really pop punk. Can he sing pop punk stuff? And Dan goes, dude, he used to be in a Green Day cover band. And he sings great pop punk stuff. And
I got to say, out of the three you've had, he actually sounds the most pop punk that I've heard out of this.
Really?
Three.
Okay.
Yeah, he's not in a bad way too. Actually a good way.
Yeah. No, his voice is amazing, but he can scream, dude. So, and that's, and assuming we survive, he does more of that. So I hadn't heard him in this pop punk stuff. So anyway, so Dan goes, you want to call him and whatever. So next thing you know, Dan and Adrian are having beers at Hooters. I don't know why he took them to Hooters, but I'm at the Hooters. And
you go where you go.
And then Dan texts me and Ben, he's like, Adrian's in. And we're like, just like that? He's like, yeah, he's in. What do we do next? Let's start writing some songs then. And we just sent, again, it was pandemic, so we weren't meeting in person. So we were sending, ideas back and forth. And when I heard his vocals on a song that I had my vocals on, I was like, oh shit, we're definitely going to continue with this.
Wow. So, and that's an interesting way to come to that. It's probably the first time you've had to deal with a new member where you were not actually rehearsing in a room all live from the beginning there.
Well, we didn't meet in person,
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy.
You've all been in the same room together now since then, right?
Oh yeah, I saw him yesterday.
How does that dynamics feel? Does it feel right to you?
Yeah, we actually did a mini tour. We went to London.
Oh yeah, I saw you did a video based on that tour. Yeah, it was good.
Thank you. yeah. So we got to actually live together for a week, you know, and you never know how that's going to go. But dude, he's so cool. Like it was seamless.
It seemed like that. Like when I watched the video, I didn't know. And that's like one of the first things I watched. And I didn't know much about the band then. I was like, oh, is this guy one of the, I thought he was you actually.
Oh, really?
At first. Cause he seems so natural.
Yeah,
like
he's great. He's super talented and super comfortable in front of people. And we got a lot of that. The response from our fans was, it feels like you guys after that show, it's like, it feels like you guys have been playing together forever. And it was our first shows together. So fortunately, we get along really well. And he's a really down-to-earth guy, really sweet guy. And, you know, I'm really excited to actually do a full tour with him and not just, you know, a couple of shows and come back. So, yeah, luckily, you know, we just were so lucky to find Adrian.
One of the last things I want to tackle, and then I'll let you go. So thank you very much.
Dude, thank you.
Since Japan is close to my heart and it seems like you do really well there. And was that a surprise when that first started happening?
Oh, yeah.
And also Scott Murphy is one of my friends who was an Alistair.
Oh, yeah.
So he has a huge Japan following too and living there and speaks amazing Japanese.
Yeah.
But I'm just curious as your relationship to it or the band and your personal relationship. Like I think you even have a video of that's filmed in Japan.
Yeah, we did an interview video there.
I mean, you're pretty well known here, but it sounds like it's even like you've hit higher charts and things, I think, in Japan.
Yeah, dude, I don't know.
Is that a surprise to you? And when did it happen?
Yeah, it was when we first came out, Waste of Mind was our first album. And I remember we got an offer to play Fuji Rock Festival there. So, we went over there and our label there at the time was Sony Music. And they really put a lot of effort behind us. Our albums started doing well there. And it, from that very first album, we started getting a pretty big following over there. So we've been going there ever since. You know, our fan base there is really diehard and, you know, they've been supporting us forever. And it's really interesting because like now we go and our fans bring their kids who are now like 7 or 8. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so like their kids are now our fans. So it's such a trip with all that. But yeah, man, we've been so fortunate that our fans in Japan have, you know, stuck with us throughout the years and we try to go there as much as we can. I think we're going back next summer to do like a full tour there. So we're really excited about that.
Do you always give yourself time to, I'm a big fan of hiking there because it's just so beautiful. Do you give yourselves time? Is it always just like move when
it's
you're
pretty
in,
much when you're with Avex there now and they are so good at making every minute there count. You know what I mean? So it's either interviews or radio stations or like taking pictures of us, you know, having boba somewhere, you know, like it's always pretty much set from the minute we get there to the minute we leave. Unless like one time I remember we didn't have a tour after. So I had like some of my family come out. And so we stayed for like a week, you know, after, and I got to kind of show them around and stuff. So that's the only time we really get a chance to go do stuff is if we stay a little bit longer and we don't have like anything following, you know, a tour there because usually we're pretty booked when we're there.
I noticed that you have a record that is just songs that were on Japan released versions, but not an American. Are those all for standard reasons why you would have different songs on it? Or are they different from each one to one or? Is there like, oh, I think this will do well here, but not in America? What's up with that?
The record label. They really preferred if you have exclusive content for. That's how that kind of came about. You know, it's usually we have a couple songs extra for the Japanese market. And so.
Yeah. And then over time, I guess you're allowed to then release them as a full thing or something. Yeah. Yeah. You have a manager, right?
Yeah. We're with Todd Singerman. He's the one that originally found us in our warehouse.
Wow.
He was Motorhead's management. And since Lemmy passed and stuff, he's been working with the other guys still. But yeah, man, he's a good friend of mine. And, you know, we've known each other for a long, long time.
Yeah, I know. Because I come from the punk movement when we first started touring, the beginning of it with Operation Ivy and Green Day and us. And we were all just doing all our own business. Like there was just, I became an accountant basically early on. And Ben was, I would say he was the lawyer and I was the accountant. Then we just took on all the business.
Wow. You know, we have a guy in our band, Ben, our bass player. He is our day-to-day guy. Like he literally does
I thought so. Yeah. Watching him in video, sometimes I can pick
up. Oh, dude, yeah.
He seems like the guy.
I'm like, Ben, anything going on today? Because I don't want to bother Todd because he has a million things, but I know Ben will know everything, you know? So, yeah, Ben is our band, like, manager and, like, takes care of everything mainly. Like, literally, I wouldn't know what I'm doing if I didn't reach out to Ben every day, so.
I feel like even when you have your own manager, it's still important to have that one guy or two. Sometimes there's two. There's like two that were like, it was me and Ben that worked together. Sometimes there's the one that everyone just goes to. Ali, I'm going to look over my notes to make sure I didn't miss anything, but that was really enjoyable.
Thanks, John. Yeah, I had a blast, man. Thank you for taking time to do this.
There's probably nothing to say about this, but I'm just curious because I also interviewed Bowling for Soup a little while ago, and they also were on the Sonic the Hedgehog soundtrack too. Yeah. Do you have crossover paths with the Bowling for Soup folks?
Dude, we've toured with them forever. I've toured with them so many times. Yeah, we're friends with those guys. I didn't realize we're on that same thing together though. That's neat.
Yeah. My other random, question is you cite System of a Down as a influence, and I could see that. And I looked up the timeline, and it's around the same time in California too that they started. Were you guys in the same scene or separate?
Not at all.
Our
management, I remember Todd, and would say, "Hey, dude, there's this band, Armenian band that is blowing up right now." And yeah. System of a Down, whatever. And I listened to them. I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah. That's how I felt when I heard them. Oh, shit.
You know? And I love the energy. I love they're so unique and everything. And I think Dan, our guitar player, is friends with those guys. He's friends with Serge, I know. But I don't really know them. Like, I take that back. I think I hung out with their old drummer a couple of times. And he was really nice. But I don't really know them or anything, but yeah, Dan does. I think he knows those guys, but they're amazing. Like one of my favorite bands of all time.
The only reason I bring it up is it's sometimes, I mean, maybe even for my audience to realize, sometimes you have a city and you think, well, maybe they're all in the same scene or something, but that's not always the case.
No. Unfortunately, we didn't ever play with them or anything. I would have fanboying out in the corner.
Yeah, I know. Even when you get to a certain amount of fame, you think that fanboy enough stuff goes away, but it never goes away, really. I had a moment with that. I'm a big 80s boy, and I had this band, the Huda Gurus from Australia. I don't know if you ever heard of them, Huda Gurus. Oh, one of my favorite bands of all time. But I just did an interview with the singer last week, and I surprised myself with my like, I turned into a little kid. Like, what am I doing? I've met some of the most famous people in the world I've worked with. You know,
you feel that way sometimes.
Yeah, it's nice to have that.
Yeah, totally agree.
All right, Ali, thank you so much for
John,
this.
John, it's a pleasure, man. And, you know, hopefully we can do it again at some point.
All right, sir.
All right, buddy.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Right,
have a good
day. Take care. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Let's go!
Just for a bit, but he's mad in rooms on the ship.
look at that. We made it to the other side. And if you did make it to the other side with us, you just got done listening to Mental Health by Zebrahead on their 2009 record, Phoenix. Thank you, everybody. I thought that was pretty good. I thought we got along pretty well, and I learned some stuff about a band I knew nothing about before. So that was great. I would like to direct you to the www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com and do the blah, blah, blah stuff. You can also, whiz yourself to PayPal and give us a one-time donation. That would be great. Anywhere from 1 cent to gazillion, billion, million quadruples. Don't give us anything negative, because that means I'd have to pay for it. And I don't want to do that. I'd like to actually make a little money, maybe a part-time job, and then continue to buy the tracks that I use for the podcast. Money that goes mostly directly to the band. I try to find the best way that I can to purchase it directly towards the band. Anyway, upcoming, we got a few. I don't know what is next. We got a recommendation from Mass Giorgini, Ricky Sticks, who is currently in the bands The 210s and Death Valley Girls. She was also in L.A. Machina with Susie Moon. We also have a podcast with two poets, Matt Hart from Squirt Gun, and also Tim Stafford, well-known Chicago personality around town. And I also had a wonderful, very intellectual conversation with Kristen Farrell, who is an artist out of California. She is also married to Brad Logan. That was a really great conversation. I had to cut it off because it was going longer than I think my audience can tolerate. But it was really enjoyable, and I would like to direct you towards that one when it comes out in February. All right, everybody, have a good day. Have a good week.